This is Dr. Gary Collins. I'm a psychologist, and it's my privilege to introduce this tape. It's a tape that isn't meant to replace a counselor, to answer all of your questions, or to solve your problems for you. But it's intended as a supplement to counseling, an added plus, which could help you as you face some of the problems of the teenage years. We know that tapes like this can be helpful to you. And I would like to introduce Dr. James Dobson. Dr. Dobson has spent a lot of time talking to teenagers, and this tape is prepared especially for you. Listen now as Dr. Dobson talks to you about being a teenager.
Hello, I'm Dr. James Dobson, and I'm really glad that you joined me today, because we're going to be talking about a very important matter. We're going to chat just as though we were very good friends, and I hope by the time we're through, we will be. And we'll discuss a subject that's extremely important, the subject of adolescence, which is one of the most exciting times of life. You'll soon find that out. There will be nothing quite like your teen years as long as you live. Nothing like them. And you'll have some of your most thrilling moments during that time, and maybe some of your scariest, too. And our purpose in this tape will be to make this period of life as wonderful and as exciting as possible. And whether you're looking forward to the teen years or you're already involved in them, you'll soon understand a little more about the questions and the problems that are likely to occur in the years immediately ahead. Well, with that introduction, I want to describe some of the new experiences that are about to occur to you. We'll be talking about the things that teenagers worry about most, the events that are often most upsetting. And I want to help you get better acquainted with your mind and with your feelings, with your emotions, with your attitudes, with your hopes and dreams, with who you are. Who are you really? Have you stopped to think about that? With where you're going and how to get there, and with the things that you're likely to face in the years ahead. Now, let's begin by playing a mental game for a moment. I'd like you to imagine yourself driving alone down a highway in a small car. You've just come through a little town by the name of Puberty, and now you're back on the main highway. And over at the right, you see a sign that says, Adultsville, 8 years straight ahead. Well, you're clipping along this highway at about 55 miles an hour, heading for this great new city that you've heard so much about. But as you round the curve, you suddenly see a man waving a red flag and holding up a warning sign. He motions for you to stop as quickly as possible. So you jam on the brakes and you skid to a halt just in front of this flag man. He comes over to the window of your car and he says, Friend, I have some very important information for you. A bridge has collapsed about 1 mile down the road, leaving a huge drop-off into a dark canyon. If you're not careful, you'll drive your car off the edge of the road and tumble down that canyon. And of course, if you do that, you'll never get to Adultsville. So what are you going to do? You can't back up because your car has no reverse gear. None of the cars that travel on this highway can go backward. That's like trying to back up on a freeway. It just can't be done. So you ask the flagman, what am I going to do? And he said, well, I have this suggestion for you. Go ahead and drive on down the road, but go slowly and carefully and keep watching for this ruined bridge. And when you get to it, turn to the right and go south for about a mile or two. Then you'll find a place where you can get around the canyon and back onto the main highway again. You don't have to fall down that hole. You can drive around it. So good luck and drive carefully. Now let me explain the meaning of the story if you haven't guessed it already. The automobile you're driving represents your own life. It has your name on the door. In fact, it has all of your characteristics. And you're driving this little sports car down the highway of life toward adulthood. And you see, I am that flagman that stands beside the road. And I'm waving a banner back and forth, and I'm holding up a warning sign, and I'm motioning for you to stop. I want to warn you about a problem that lies down the road. It's a canyon that most teenagers fall into on the road to adulthood. This isn't a problem that just affects a few teenagers. Nearly everybody has to deal with it one way or another during the adolescent years. So after I've motioned you to stop, I lean in the window of your car, and I tell you that many other young people have wrecked their lives by plunging down into this dark gorge, and I can show you how to avoid it, how to go around the danger. But what is this problem, which so many adolescents face at this time of life? Why don't you take a guess at that at this moment? Maybe you want to turn off the tape and talk about it. What is it that causes so much hurt and pain to young people between 12 and 20 years of age? It's a feeling of hopelessness that we call inferiority. It's that awful awareness that nobody likes you, that you're not as good as other people, that you're a failure, a loser, a personal disaster, that you're ugly or unintelligent, or you don't have as much ability as someone else. You see, it's that depressing feeling of worthlessness. Now, this is the canyon I was talking about, that dark hole in the roadway to adulthood that captures so many young people. Recently, I was interviewed by the editors of Teen Magazine. Perhaps you've seen that magazine on the newsstands. They wanted me to do an article that was being prepared on the subject of inferiority. And the editors of this magazine knew, as I do, that most teenagers face this problem. And I tried to tell their readers that this is an unnecessary crisis. You can go around the difficulty and avoid it if you know what to expect. But if you simply drive your car down the highway full speed ahead without thinking about these dangers and without being aware of them, you too can fall victim to this same feeling of worthlessness. It doesn't make sense that we should all have to suffer this agony of defeat. We all have human worth, every one of us. You have human worth, and I do too. Yet so many young people conclude that they're somehow different, that they're truly inferior, that they lack the necessary ingredients for dignity and worth. Now, some of you know that I often work with young people who have these kinds of problems, as well as physical problems. I've been on the staff of a children's hospital for about 10 years, but I previously served on a high school campus, and there I worked with many teenagers who were struggling with some of the feelings that I've been describing to you today. That's how I'm so familiar with it, because I've seen it hundreds and hundreds of times. One day I was walking across the grounds of the high school after the bell had rung, and most of the students were already back in class. But I saw a boy coming toward me in the main hall there, and I knew his name. I knew his name was Ronnie, and I knew that he was in his third year of high school, but I didn't know him very well. Ronnie was one of those many students who remained back in the crowd, never calling attention to themselves and never making friends with people around them. It's easy to forget that they're even alive because they never allow anybody to get very well acquainted with them. Well, when Ronnie was about 15 feet away from me, I saw that he was very upset about something. It was obvious that he was distressed because his face revealed this inner turmoil. And as he came a few feet closer to me, he saw that I was watching him. Our eyes locked there for a minute, and then he looked down at the floor as we passed, and he wouldn't look at me, and then I knew he was really in trouble. And when Ronnie and I were parallel, side by side, he suddenly covered his face with both hands, and he turned toward the wall, and his neck turned red, and his ears turned red, and he began to sob and weep. And he wasn't just crying. He seemed to explode with emotion. I put my arm around him and I said, "Can I help you, Ronnie? Do you feel like talking to me?" And he nodded that he did. And I practically had to lead him into my office. And I offered him a chair and I closed the door and I gave him a few minutes to get control of himself because he couldn't even talk to me. And then he began to speak. He said, "I've been going to school in this district for 8 years. And in all that time, I have never managed to make one single friend. Not one. There's not a soul in this high school who cares whether I live or die. He said, I walk to school by myself and I walk home alone. And I don't go to football games and I don't go to basketball games or any school activities because I'm embarrassed to sit there all by myself. And I stand all by myself at snack time in the morning and I eat lunch out in a quiet corner of the campus. And then he said, I go back to class by myself. My telephone never rings. Nobody ever calls me. I don't get along with my dad, and my mother doesn't understand me, and I fight with my sister. And I have nobody. I have no one to talk to. Nobody knows what I feel, and nobody cares. And sometimes I think I just can't stand it anymore. I cannot tell you how many students have expressed those same feelings to me. One eighth grade girl named Charlotte felt so badly about herself and about being unpopular and not liked by the other students that she didn't even want to live anymore. She came to school one day and told me she had taken all the pills that were available in the medicine cabinet in an attempt to do away with herself. But she didn't really want to die, or else she wouldn't have told me what she'd done. She was actually calling for help, you see. The school nurse and I got her to the hospital just in time to save her life. Both Charlotte and Ronnie are among many thousands of students who feel overwhelmed by their own worthlessness, and they sometimes even lose their interest in living because of it. Now, some young people feel inferior and foolish only occasionally, such as when they fail at something very important. Perhaps you're in that category. But others feel worthless all the time, 24 hours a day. Maybe you're one of those individuals that hurts every single day. Have you ever had that big lump in your throat that comes when you feel that nobody cares, that nobody likes you, that maybe they even hate you? Have you ever wished that you could just crawl out of your skin and get into another person's body? Do you ever feel like a complete dummy when you're in a group? Would you ever like to just crawl into a hole and disappear? If you've ever had those kind of feelings, I hope you'll finish listening to this tape, because it's for you. I wish Ronnie and Charlotte could have heard what I'm trying to say at this time, when they expressed those feelings of inferiority. I wish they could have recognized their true worth as human beings. They had, you see, driven into the canyon of inferiority, and they were groping in the darkness below. Now let's ask a very important question. Why do so many teenagers feel inferior? That's a very good question. Why can't American young people grow up liking themselves? Why is it common for people to examine themselves and to be bitterly disappointed with the person God has made them? Why is it necessary for everyone to bump his head on the same old rock? These are very important questions, and I believe there are good answers for them as well. As young people grow up in our American society today, there are three things that teenagers feel they must have in order to feel good about themselves. And the first of these, and by far the most important, is physical attractiveness, beauty. Did you know that about 80% of the teenagers in our society don't like the way they look? 80%. The girls feel too tall and the boys feel too short, or they feel too fat or too thin, or they're worried about the pimples on their faces, or about the freckles on their noses, or the color of their hair, or they think their feet are too big, or they don't like their fingernails. You see, no matter how minor the problem is, it can create great anxieties and depression. And most teenagers examine themselves carefully in the mirror to see how much damage has been done by Mother Nature, and most of them don't like what they see. You see, since none of us is perfect, they usually find something about themselves that they don't like, and then they worry about it and fret about it, wishing that they didn't have that flaw. Can you imagine being depressed and miserable over something as silly as having a nose that's a fraction of an inch longer than you think it should be? This is the kind of thing that bothers many, many teenagers. Now, one reason people during the adolescent years become so sensitive about these kind of tiny flaws is because their friends have teased them and embarrassed them during the early years. Unfortunately, boys and girls are often brutal to one another, even from 3 or 4 years of age, and they hurl insults back and forth like poison darts. I knew a third-grade girl, for example, who received a note at school from another girl who apparently hated her. She had done nothing unkind to the writer of this note, but this is what it said. I have the note in front of me. It said, "Awful Janet, you're the stinkest girl in the world. I hope you die. But of course, I suppose that's impossible. I've got some ideals. 1, play in the road. 2, cut your throat." I suppose she meant throat. 3, drink poison. 4, get drunk. 5, knife yourself. Please do some of this, you big fat girl. We all hate you. I'm praying, oh Lord, please let Janet die. We're in need of fresh air. Did you hear me, Lord? 'Cause if you didn't, we'll all die here with her. See, Janet, we're not all bad." From Wanda Jackson. Isn't that an incredible message? Can you imagine having a note like that laid on your desk and what it would do to you? Have you ever had something like that happen, where someone was just as vicious as they knew how to be, trying to tear you down and make you feel bad about yourself and hate yourself? Notice the implication in that note, that everybody else is thinking this way. See, Wanda Jackson didn't just say, "I feel that way about you." She said, "We're not all bad, and we wish you would die," putting herself with the group and making Janet feel like she's all alone. Now, one of the most damaging games played by teenagers is to create unkind nicknames that draw attention to anything different or unusual about a person. In this way, they put the spotlight on the feature that the victim most wants to hide. You may have been given a nickname or teased about your body at some time or another. If you're a small boy, you may have been called runt or peewee. If you're a big girl, you may have been called moose or gorilla. If you have large ears, they may have called you Dumbo. You see, no one, absolutely no one, has a perfect body. And everyone has something that can be made fun of. Even Farrah Fawcett Majors, the Hollywood beauty, recently said that she thought her mouth was too big. I never really noticed that. Maybe you didn't either. At least Farrah was able to talk about her imperfection. Most people try to conceal theirs in shame. Let me illustrate this a little bit more. Let's suppose that Charlie is a healthy boy. He's 10 years of age. He has a strong body, a sharp mind, and a very loving home. He's been blessed by many good things in life, and he experiences very few problems. Then one day, a group of students on the playground begins teasing him about his big feet. They call him snowshoes and duck feet. It's all done in fun, I guess, but Charlie takes it very seriously, and he becomes extremely sensitive about the size of his feet, and he thinks everyone is laughing behind his back. He tries to hide his feet under his desk at school, and he insists that his mother buy him shoes that are 3 sizes too small. Eventually, Charlie may even become depressed and disinterested in living instead of being a happy fellow who enjoys the advantages God has given to him. You see, this illustration may sound unreal to you, but please believe me, I know many Charlies who have been made to dislike themselves over very minor flaws. If you're not yet a teenager, you ought to know that you are also likely to be dissatisfied with your body in the future. If your concern is great, it may cause you to be shy and very easily embarrassed, blushing and pulling back from the group. Or it may lead you to do the opposite, to be very loud and angry because you feel foolish and you think that nobody likes you anyway. There's just no way for me to estimate the amount of pain and worry that teenagers feel over the way they look. This concern was expressed in the words of a popular song a while back that was written by Janice Ian. In fact, she won a Grammy Award in 1976 for the song entitled At 17. Let me read the words of that song to you so you can see how feelings of inferiority are reflected throughout this song. Janice Ian said, I learned the truth at 17, that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear-skinned smiles who married young and then retired. Her reference there to clear-skinned smiles, of course, refers to the matter of acne and pimples that agitate so many young people. She said, the Valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth, that means football games and slumber parties and that kind of thing, they were spent on one more beautiful. At 17, I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me, and murmured vague obscenities. It isn't all it seems at 17. Now get these last two stanzas. To those of us who knew the pain of Valentines that never came, and those whose names were never called when choosing sides for basketball. Well, it was long ago and far away, and the world was younger than today. And dreams were all they gave for free to ugly duckling girls like me. I don't know Janice Ian. I've never met her, but there's one thing I know about her. She has been down in the canyon of inferiority because she could not possibly have written the words of that song without understanding what I'm trying to talk to you about today. It has to do with those deep feelings that I have no value and I have no worth, primarily because I am ugly and unacceptable to the opposite sex. Well, a second characteristic that young people don't like about themselves is that they often feel unintelligent, or in the words of kids, they feel dumb. This is a feeling that begins during the very early school years when they begin having trouble learning in school. Parents, too, can accidentally make their children feel that they aren't very smart because we adults are human beings, too, and we get impatient, we get tired. Just like you do. And this sometimes causes adults to become upset when their kids don't do well in school, or when the report card doesn't look like it should, or when they have trouble learning the multiplication tables. And they may, in a moment of weakness and fatigue, call their kids insulting names, which are remembered for a lifetime. So children often grow up thinking that they're stupid and dumb, and this is the second reason why feelings of inferiority are so common among junior high school and high school students. Now, the third value that young people use to measure their worth is money. You see, they think that the wealthy family is more important than the poor one. And to be accepted and popular, you have to dress a certain way. Or your family has to have a certain kind of car. Or you have to live in a big house in the right part of town. And your father has to have a certain kind of job. So beauty, intelligence, and money are the three attributes valued most highly in our society. And when junior high students first discover that they're lacking in one of those three, or perhaps all three, of these characteristics, then they begin sliding downward in despair. And for them, the bridge has collapsed, and a dark canyon looms below. Now, if you're one of those young people who already feels bad about life, if you feel miserable about yourself and you'd like to escape somehow, just run away from it all. Or if you've been hurt when someone said unkind words or wrote you a note like the one sent to awful Janet, let me give you several suggestions that I think will help you. Number one, recognize that you are not alone, even though you may feel lonely. First, I suggest that you begin to look at the people around you to see if you can detect these same feelings of inferiority in them as well. Unless you take a second look at the people that you associate with, you might never know that they ever had a care in the world because they're laughing and joking and they seem so happy. But I assure you that many of them, yea, most of them, have the same concerns that trouble you. They'll reveal these kind of doubts, if you watch them, by being very shy and quiet, you know, never raising their hand in the classroom to ask a question, or by being extremely angry and mean, or by being very silly, by being a clown in the classroom, or perhaps by being afraid to participate in a game or a contest, or they'll blush very frequently, or they'll act proud and stuck up and boastful. You'll soon to recognize these signs of inferiority, and I think it'll give you confidence to know that everyone is afraid of embarrassment and ridicule, and we're all sitting in that same leaky boat. Everybody's trying to plug the same watery holes. The second suggestion that I hope will be helpful to you is to face the issue of what's bugging you. Look squarely at the thought that keeps gnawing at you from the back of your mind or from deep within your heart, and it causes a black cloud to hang over your head day and night. I think it'd be a good idea to get alone where there is no one to interfere with your thoughts, and then list all of the things that you most dislike about yourself. Nobody's going to see that paper except the people you choose to show it to, so you can be completely honest at that moment. And I suggest that you withhold nothing from this writing assignment. Put it all down, and then when you're finished, go back through that list and put a check mark by the items that worry you most, the problems that you spend the most time thinking about and worrying about.
Perhaps this would be a good time for you to stop the tape and to make a list of the things which you most dislike about yourself. Then, as Dr. Dobson suggests, put a check mark next to the items that worry you most. When you have done this, please turn the tape on again and continue listening.
Then you're ready for a very important step. Find a true friend that you can talk to. This should be an adult, someone who understands the problems of young people. Maybe it'll be one of your parents, or your teacher, or your counselor, or your pastor, or your youth pastor. You'll know who the right person is. Take your list to that trusted leader and go over it with him or her and discuss each one of your problems. They're in an atmosphere of openness and love. Talk about your feelings. Ask your friend to make suggestions about changing the things that concern you. Now, it's very likely that many of the problems that you face have been conquered by other people, and you may be able to profit from their experience. But that raises a very important question. How will you handle the remaining items on your list, those matters that can't be changed? It would be wise for you to remember that the best way to have a healthy mind is to learn to accept those things that you cannot change. There will always be circumstances in your life which you wish you could remove or rearrange. However, the happiest people in the world are not those who have no problems, but they are the people who have learned to live with those things that are less than perfect. Let me suggest then that you take your remaining list of unsolvable problems to a private place where a small fire will not be dangerous. And maybe you'd like to have your counselor friend present for this ceremony. Then I suggest that you burn that paper as a symbol to God that the problems are now His. And your prayer ought to contain a message similar to this. Dear Jesus, I'm bringing all my problems and worries to you tonight because you are my best friend in the whole world. You already know about my strengths and weaknesses because you made me. That's why I'm burning this paper now. It's my way of saying that I'm giving my life to you, with my good qualities along with my shortcomings and my failures. I'm asking you to use me in whatever way you wish. Make me the kind of person you want me to be. And from this moment forward, I am not going to worry about my imperfections. And I know that you'll find great love and great warmth and great acceptance from God when you pray that kind of prayer. And by doing so, you're saying, I want your will for my life, not because I'm a superstar or a superman or a superwoman, but because you promised to help those who admit their weaknesses. I don't have to hide it from you. I'm depending on your power and your strength to make something beautiful out of my life. All right, let's take the third suggestion, which I call compensate for your weaknesses. There's a very important word that you ought to understand, and it's called compensation. Compensation may be a $10 word, but it has a very simple meaning. It means to make up for your weaknesses by concentrating on your strengths. In other words, to compensate for your weaknesses. Not everybody can be the best-looking person in school. If this is your situation, you say, all right, so what? There are a lot of other people in the same boat, and it really doesn't matter. My worth does not depend on the arrangement of my body. I'll put my effort into something that will help me feel good about myself. I'll be the best trumpet player in the band. Or I'll succeed in my part-time job. Or I'll raise rabbits for fun and profit. Or I'll make good grades in school. Or I'll see how many friends I can make. Or I'll learn to play basketball as well as possible. Or I'll become a good pianist or a drummer. Or I'll just see how pleasant a personality I can develop. And that's something nearly everyone can work on. Or I'll learn to play tennis, or I'll be a seamstress. Or I'll draw or paint or express myself through art. Or I'll write poetry or short stories. Or I'll become a good cook. Or maybe you could just become highly skilled at entertaining and taking care of small children. And becoming well-trained as a child care worker. That's a very important task. So you see, there's success waiting for you if you'll just look for it. So develop a skill that will make you proud of yourself. And gradually, you'll begin to have a better self-image or self-concept. And you'll begin to like yourself a little bit more. And when you like yourself better, so will other people. Well, this brings us to the fourth suggestion. And this is it. Nothing helps your self-confidence more than genuine friends. When you know that other people like you, it's a whole lot easier to accept yourself. You don't have to be beautiful or highly intelligent or wealthy in order to be liked by other people. The best way to have a friend is to be a good friend to others. That's a very old proverb, but it's still very true. Now, how can you make new friends quickly and easily? You need to remember that the people you deal with every day, listen carefully to this now, the people you deal with every day have exactly the same problems I've been discussing with you. And understanding that fact will help you to know how to get along with them and earn their respect. Never make fun of people or ridicule them. They'll get you back if you do that. Let them know that you respect them and accept them. And that they're important to you. And make a conscious effort to show this kind of affection for people. Learn to protect the reputation of other people. And they'll do the same for you in return. Be sensitive to their feelings. They have the same needs that you do. Be kind to them. And when you've befriended someone in this way, they will remember your generosity and they'll look for ways to return your kindness. It just works that way. One of the most important responsibilities in the Christian life is to care about other people, to smile at them, to be a friend to the friendless. You see, God wants to use you to help His other children who also feel inferior. And He said, quote, "Inasmuch as you do it to the least of these my brethren, you are doing it unto me." So if you'll start living this kind of Christian life as recommended in the Bible, I know that you'll find self-confidence will grow and that God will bless you for it because the Lord honors those who obey Him. Now, let me stress one more time the attributes which our society values, beauty, intelligence, and money, need to be seen from the Christian point of view. These are man's values, but they are not God's values. The Lord does not measure your worth the way other people do. He emphasizes this throughout His Word, that each of us is worth more than the possessions of the entire world. This is true because we're human beings, not because of the way we look, or to whom we're married, or what our parents do, or how much money we have, or how much we don't have, or how much we've accomplished in life. those are earthly factors and they don't really make much difference. So let me say this to those of you who have not yet suffered the feelings of inferiority that I'm describing. I hope you'll remember my illustration of driving a car down the road. You don't have to fall into that black hole. You don't have to tumble into the canyon with all the other wrecked cars at the bottom. You can drive your car around that dangerous drop-off. So don't let it happen to you. Don't listen to that little voice in the next few years, which is likely to say to you, "You're not worthy. You're a failure. There's something wrong with you. You're ugly. There's something wrong with your mind. You're different. Do you know everybody is laughing at you? They think you're a fool. You're going to be a failure in life. Everything will go wrong." Don't believe it. Steer your car around the canyon of inferiority. God will help you do it.
This concludes side one of this tape on the teenage years. Please turn over the tape and listen as Dr. Dobson continues his presentation on side two of the tape.
We've been talking about feelings of inferiority, which are so very, very common during the teen years. And in fact, not only during the teen years, but throughout life. Older people also struggle with some of these same feelings of self-doubt and worthlessness. But let's turn our attention now to a second problem, a second major issue that's likely to be of some concern during the teen years. And it will focus on a matter which we call conformity. What does the word conformity mean to you? Just what is that mysterious word in the dictionary? Does it have any relevance to your daily living? Have you ever heard it before? You may never have used this word, but you do need to become very familiar with its meaning. It'll play a very important role during the adolescent period of your life. The word conformity refers to the desire to be just like everyone else.
to do what they do and say what they say and think what they think and wear what they wear. A conformist is someone who's afraid to be different from the majority, from the group. He feels a great need to be like everybody else. To conform means to accept the ideas and the fashion, the way of walking, the way of talking, that's popular at the time. And in our society, there is a tremendous pressure on all of us to conform to the standards of the group. This pressure to conform is so strong in some people that they even feel uncomfortable if they're different in any way at all. If flared pants are in for boys, woe to the fellow who doesn't get the message and wears tapered pants. If a girl walks funny or talks with a lisp, she may be laughed at every day at school. If Fords and Chevrolets are popular at high school, a person had better not buy a Plymouth. That would be an insult to the entire student body. You see, any little deviation, any change at all in what the group declares, this is what we do, becomes a breach of etiquette. They point at the offender and they talk disrespectfully about him, and they make him feel very uncomfortable. Now, I want you to understand that this pressure to conform is at its worst during adolescence, more than any other time of life. And that's why teenagers move in such a herd, like a flock of sheep, as we'll see. A team of doctors decided to conduct an experiment to study the ways in which this kind of group pressure influences young people. And to accomplish this, they invited 10 teenagers into a room, and they told them they were going to evaluate their perception in order to learn how well each student could see the front of the room from where he sat. But just between us, all the teenagers were very close to the front of the room, and everybody could see quite easily. What the doctors were actually studying was not the students' eyesight, but the effects of this kind of group pressure. So the doctor said, we're going to hold up some cards at the front of the room, and on each card are three lines, line A, line B, and line C. Each will be a different length. In some cases, line A will be the longest. In other cases, line B will be the longest. And in still other cases, line C will be the longest. Several dozen cards will be shown with the lines in a different order. Now we'll hold them up and we'll point to line A, line B, and line C on each card. Now listen to this. When we point to the longest line, please raise your hand to show that you know that it's longer than the others. So they repeated these directions to be sure everybody understood. It's very simple. When we point to a line, if it's the longest one, raise your hand. And then they raised the first card and pointed to the top line. Well, what one student didn't know was that the other nine had been secretly informed earlier to vote not for the longest line, but for the second longest line. In other words, they were told to vote wrongly. So the doctors held up the first card and pointed to line A, which was clearly shorter than line B. And at that point, all nine students cooperated in this scheme, and they raised their hands. Well, the fellow that was being studied didn't know that the other nine were in on the joke, and he looked around in disbelief. It was obvious that line B was longer than line A, but everybody else seemed to think line A was longer. And he later admitted that he was thinking, boy, I must not have been listening during the directions. Somehow I missed the point, and I'd better do what everybody else is doing or they'll laugh at me. So he carefully raised his hand with the rest of the group. Then these researchers explained the directions again, and they said, be sure now that you're voting for what you see as the longest line. Raise your hand when we point to the longest line. It could not have been more simple. Then they held up the second card, and again, nine people voted for the wrong line. And the confused fellow became even more tense over this predicament. But eventually he raised his hand with the group once more. Over and over again, he voted with the group, even though he knew they were wrong. This one young man was not unusual. In fact, more than 75% of the young people that were tested behaved in the same way. They sat there time after time saying that a short line was longer than a long line. They simply didn't have the courage to say, the group is wrong. I can't explain why, but you guys are all confused. A very small percentage, only 25 out of 100, had the courage to take their stand against the group, even when the majority was obviously wrong. This is what group pressure does to an insecure person. And it's also very closely related to what we were talking about before of inferiority. See, the more inadequate you feel, the more worthless you feel, the more you think people are laughing at you anyway, the more there is pressure on you to conform because you can't stand to be laughed at and left out. It's just too uncomfortable to not be part of the group. So the greater the feelings of inferiority, the greater the conformity. Those two things go together. Now let's return to that study that I was just talking about, because there's another very interesting characteristic that it revealed. If just one other student recognized and voted for the right line, then the chances were greatly improved that the fellow who was being studied would also do what he thought was right. This means that if you have even one friend who will stand with you against the group, you'll probably have more courage too. But when you're all by yourself, you know, it's pretty difficult to take your stand alone. Now let's think about some very relevant questions. Why will this subject of conformity be important to you as you go into the adolescent years? Can you see any reason at all why peer pressure could be dangerous to you? Stop and think about that for a minute. Do you see any ways at all that it could get you into trouble a little bit later? How does conformity hurt you right now? That's also an important question. How does it keep you from doing what's right? How could it interfere with your life? Well, the reason conformity is dangerous is that it can cause you to do things that you know are wrong. This is what happens when you don't have the courage to be different from your friends because of feelings of inferiority. Let me give you an illustration of what I'm trying to say. Let's suppose that you're in a car with four other young people, and each of you is about 15 years of age at this time, and you're driving around at night and you're looking for fun and having a good time, when the driver of the car reaches into his pocket and he takes out a bottle with some little red pills in it. And he takes one pill and he pops it in his mouth, and then he hands the bottle to the guy sitting by the door in the front seat. And he laughs and he takes a pill before handing the bottle to the three of you in the back seat. Now, you're the last one to be handed the bottle over at the left. And all four of your friends have taken those pills. And as it's handed to you, what are you going to say? You know that those capsules are called reds and that they're very harmful to the body. You don't want to take them, but you don't want to be laughed at either. You hesitate for a moment, which causes the fellow beside you to say, "Come on, sissy, what's the matter? You scared? Hey, guys, we got a mama's boy back here. He's afraid daddy'll find out. Who would have thought that Jackie boy was a big chicken? Come on, baby face, try it. You'll like it." And your hands tremble a little bit, and you got a funny feeling in your stomach because you know this is not what God wants you to do. You know it's not what's right. You only have one body, and you're about to abuse it in this way. And yet the pressure is enormous. You don't like to be laughed at. It makes you uncomfortable to be laughed at. And yet here are those pills being handed to you, and what are you going to do? And then the other boys begin to tease you too, because they want you to do what they're doing. Enormous pressure in that car at that moment. Your heart is pounding. You don't know what to say. You just feel foolish. So you think, maybe I should try it just once to see what it's like. That probably won't hurt much. So you give in. You pop the pill. And what a relief to be one of the boys again. Let me let you in on a very important secret at this point. Having taken that pill one time makes it infinitely easier to take the next one because you've done it before. Then it is so simple to start getting the habit. Your body begins to crave it and demand it. And soon, like so many others, you can be seriously hooked on narcotics, not because you wanted to, not because you sought it, not because you went out and tried to buy it, but because of the pressure of conformity. You didn't have the courage to say no. See, this explains the most important reason why drugs are being used by thousands upon thousands of teenagers every day throughout this country. They're permanently damaging their bodies in this way. The human body is so very, very delicate, and it can be hurt, so that the rest of a person's life is spent in pain. Or if a person overdoses on the drugs, he can actually kill himself while he's trying to have a little fun. I talked to a 13-year-old girl the other day who takes 10 to 20 Reds every day of her life. Her body is so racked and ruined from these narcotics that she will never be healthy again. What a shame, what a shame to destroy a youthful body in that way. How unfortunate that she didn't have the courage to reply to that person who first offered her drugs. Why should I wreck my body? It's the only one I have. Other harmful behaviors can also be traced to this same pressure of conformity. Why do you suppose teenage alcoholism is such a serious problem in this country? Why else would cigarettes continue to be smoked by young people, even though they know the habit has been proven to shorten life and contaminate the lungs and increase the risk of cancer and damage the blood vessels? Why do you think teenagers pick up that first cigarette and inhale the filthy smoke into their pink lungs? It usually begins by a friend, and I put that in quotes, some friend, who offers a weed to a person who's never smoked, and he says, "Would you like a puff?" And unfortunately, the non-smoker lacks the guts to say, "No way." It'll be helpful for you to think about these issues before you face the crisis with your friends, before you're sitting in the back seat of that car and the drugs are coming your way. Think it out and decide what you're going to do about it. Recognize the fact that your friends are under the same pressure that you feel, and they're tempted to take drugs or smoke or drink for the same reason that you are, simply because they're afraid to be different. I'll tell you something else. Most teenagers respect a guy or a girl who has the courage to be his own person, even when he's mocked and teased. An individual who has this kind of confidence often becomes a leader. Instead of following the pack, he sets the pace, because he's shown that he doesn't feel as inferior as other people. He's not made of putty inside. Instead, he has the guts to stand up for what he knows is right. And one other thing, he's likely to influence others who are looking for that one friend who will increase their confidence. Remember the experiment with the cards? He might make it possible for someone else to oppose this destructive peer pressure too. So the pressure of conformity is not only harmful to young people who take drugs and smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol. Now listen to this, because this is extremely important. Even if you do not get into trouble with alcohol and drugs and those kinds of problems, this is a place where you may fall into the canyon of inferiority. Because conformity can be especially damaging to those teenagers who can't be like their friends. In the high school where I served as a counselor, for example, there was a blind student who could not accept the fact that she was different from the other students. And her way of dealing with her blindness was to deny that it existed. She refused the help of a special teacher who was hired to work with her. She wouldn't do the work the teacher gave her to do, or she wouldn't even talk to this specialist. She even tried to walk without using her white cane or a seeing eye dog. She put her shoulders back and walked down the sidewalk of the school just as though she knew exactly where she was going. And one day I saw her heading in the wrong direction, but before I could stop her, she walked right into a post. Nevertheless, she simply refused to feel her way around. You see, this unfortunate young lady could not accept the fact that she was different from the normal students. I put normal in quotes. Consequently, she suffered from great feelings of inferiority. I've seen deaf children refuse to wear a hearing aid, which would have made it possible for them to hear what was going on in school. One second grader refused to wear, quote, "that thing in my ear," unquote, because it made him feel foolish. and he would take it off just as soon as he left home each morning, even though he could hear very little of what went on in the classroom. He felt he had to be like the group. I know of one little 4-year-old boy whose glasses were lost at home, and his family looked all over the house, and they couldn't find them, and the child didn't seem to know where they were either. Finally, he confessed, "Mommy, I got something to tell you." And she asked, "What?" And he said, "I can find my glasses for you." And they went out in the backyard, and he retrieved them from a hole in the ground. This 4-year-old child had buried his glasses because they made him feel different. This is the discomfort felt by those who can't conform, and they need our understanding and our kindness. I'm reminded of a second grader named Jeff that I met a few years ago, and his teacher came to me and asked me to help solve a riddle. She noticed that Jeff always wore big, thick leather gloves to school every day, and he was rarely seen without these dumb-looking gloves, even on the warmest days of the year. He obviously wasn't using them just to keep his hands warm. He wore them in the springtime, and in September he wore them all year round. And his teacher would make him take them off, of course, when he was in the classroom, because he couldn't even hold a pencil with these thick, padded fingers. But the moment Jeff went out to recess or lunch, he put the gloves on again. And his teacher just couldn't understand the reason for this behavior. Why was he so in love with those gloves? They weren't new, they weren't expensive. In fact, they were all scratched and dirty. But in talking to me about this problem, Jeff's teacher casually mentioned that he was the only black child in a classroom of white children. Then Jeff's behavior became very easy to understand. He was bothered, you see, by being different from his friends, just as you and I would have been. You see, when Jeff wore a long-sleeved shirt and trousers and shoes and socks, the only part of his skin that he could see was his hands. He couldn't see his face. And by wearing these gloves, Jeff couldn't see his own black hands. His black skin did not make him inferior, but it made him feel unusual because he was the only non-white child in his room, and he was embarrassed by this difference, and he tried to cover it up. We need to understand friends like Jeff who feel inadequate and inferior. In fact, if we really love others as much as ourselves, we'll give as much time and attention to helping them avoid pain and ridicule as we do ourselves. We'll think about them as often as we think about ourselves. We'll befriend the person who's a little different, or who's new at our school, or who's a foreign student with a strange accent, or who's in some kind of embarrassing position. The Bible says that when you help that kind of needy person, it's just as though you were doing it for Jesus himself. More than any other concept, this is the meaning of Christianity. And it takes us back to the principles of the Bible, which should guide our behavior in virtually every area of life. The Scriptures speak very plainly about the dangers of conformity. Romans 12:2 warns, "Be not conformed to this world." In other words, don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. "But be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." Now that's written in the King James Version of the Bible. Let me read it now in the Living Bible. This is the same verse. "Don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but be a new and different person with a fresh newness in all that you do and think. Then you will learn from your own experience how His ways will really satisfy you." It's obvious from these verses and from many others in the Bible that God does not want us to follow the whims of the world around us. He expects us to say to ourselves, "I am going to control my behavior and my mind and my body and my life. And I will be like my friends in ways that don't matter, such as wearing fashionable clothes when it's convenient. But when it comes to being moral and obeying God and learning in school and keeping my body clean and healthy, then I won't let anybody tell me what to do. If they must laugh at me, then let them laugh. The joke won't be funny for very long. I'm not going to let anything keep me from living a Christian life. In other words, I will not conform." and I know you'll be happier for it.
Before Dr. Dobson completes his presentation, it might be good for us to stop the tape and look at the questions on your tape guide sheet. There are four of them. What is causing you the most difficulty in your life right now? What have you done in an attempt to overcome your personal struggle or struggles? After listening to this tape, what have you learned that may be helpful in handling your struggle? Write down what you would like to spend more time discussing with your counselor. Let me suggest that you take a few minutes to write down some answers to these questions. When you have done so, turn the tape back on for some further suggestions.
Well, I think we've covered two of the most important subjects that you ought to know about the adolescent experience. We've talked about inferiority and its first cousin, conformity. And all that remains now is to offer one or two final suggestions that may help you cope with the pressures that we've been discussing. First, listen carefully now, there's a tendency during the adolescent years to feel that today is forever, that present circumstances aren't ever going to change, that the problems you face at this moment are going to continue for the rest of your life. In truth, however, the teen years will pass very, very quickly and will soon be nothing but a dim memory to you. If you find yourself unhappy for one reason or another during the adolescent years, just hang tough. Things are going to change. I make that a promise to you. Tomorrow will be different from today. Let me offer one other encouraging message about the adolescent years, which can be summarized in three little words. Normality will return. By that I mean that you're about to go into a hectic, topsy-turvy world, which will make new demands and will confront you with many new challenges. And when these stressful moments arrive, when you ask a girl for a date and she turns you down, when you don't get invited to the party being given for the popular people, when your parents seem to hassle you over everything that you do, when pimples and blackheads attack your forehead like an army of insects, when you wonder if God is really there and if He genuinely cares, in those moments when you're tempted to give up, please remember my words, normality will return. The final, but perhaps the most important advice that I can give you is to remain friends with Jesus Christ during the years ahead. He loves you and understands all of your needs and desires. He'll be there to share your brightest days and your darkest nights. And when you face the important decisions of life, choosing a mate and selecting an occupation, He'll guide your footsteps. He gave us that assurance in Proverbs 3:6, which says, "In all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct thy paths." What a comforting promise! I want to thank you for taking this ride through the adolescent years with me. Even though you and I have never been introduced, I feel that this conversation has permitted us to become very good friends. In fact, I wish that you'd write me and tell me about your own teen experiences. Unfortunately, I receive more mail than I can possibly answer, but I read every letter that comes. And I trust that God will bless your life, and I hope to meet you someday.
This concludes Side 2 of the tape. Please don't forget to return this tape to your counselor. When you do so, take along any notes, growth activities, and anything else you may have written down while listening to the tape. Your counselor would be interested in discussing these things with you. The examples on this tape are either fictitious or used with the permission of the people involved. Any resemblance to people that you might know is purely a coincidence.